Shalom, salam. Thank you for inviting me to speak to you this morning. I am speaking about my commitment to pursuing peace as a rodefet shalom, one who actively seeks peace. Before I begin my remarks to you, I ask each of you to reflect for a moment on why you are here. Reflect in the most specific way, why have you come to this church this morning? And why also, in the most general sense, why have you been given this life? What are you here on this earth to do? These are the questions that motivate me. Presumably, most of you will answer the first question by recognizing the spiritual sustenance you receive from this place, this community, and its leadership. What action, work, or service does that sustenance prepare you for? Perhaps you find resources for maintaining your faith in others and courage to keep up the good fight. Perhaps you find people or a theology that holds you accountable for how you use your precious human abilities. Why do we come together to pray? Does God really need our prayers? Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, may his memory always be a blessing, taught us he felt like his feet were praying when he marched with Dr. King for civil rights. He also taught, prayer is meaningless unless it is subversive, unless it seeks to overthrow and to ruin the pyramids of callousness, hatred, opportunism, falsehoods. Every week, I pray Psalm 34. Do you know Psalm 34, verse 14? It demands of me, Bakesh shalom v'rodfehu. Seek peace and pursue it. Not just seek it, but actively pursue it. Our sacred scripture, the Torah, specifically, Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 20, instructs me, indeed requires of me, that I be an active seeker of justice, tzedek tzedek tirdof, not just seek justice, but you shall surely seek justice. For me as a Jew, to live my faith with integrity, I must actually act. It is not enough to wish or hope for peace. It is not enough to say, I support a peace agreement between the Israeli Jews and the Palestinians. At a minimum, I am compelled to witness, to educate, and to speak out in any way I can by showing up at demonstrations, signing petitions, writing letters to political leaders, or to the editor. It is what brings me to you this morning. I am assuming, I hope correctly, a high degree of literacy about the issues regarding Israel and Palestine. So instead of sharing with you a lot of facts and figures, I thought I would tell you my story. How did a rabbi come to be a supporter of justice for Palestinians? I grew up in a conservative Jewish congregation celebrating the miracle of a young Israeli nation. Israeli Independence Day was added to the calendar of Jewish holidays taught and observed by the community, as was Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. I grew up with a love for Israel and a connection to the country's well-being. I never knew anything about the Nakba or the dispossession of the Palestinian people who were living on the land. In fact, I was given an easy reader, Hebrew books, you know, to help learn the language. We actually were given some short, easy reader Hebrew books and stories about Jewish settlers fighting to protect their farms and kibbutzim from Arab attackers. As a 14 or 15-year-old, I learned the Hebrew words for rifle and bomb and attack. For perspective, the history of Israel's War of Independence and the decisions of the leaders at that time, 1948, was not available to scholars or laymen. It wasn't until the unsealing of the historical record in 1998, when Israeli scholars began studying and writing about the history surrounding the founding of the state. Their research and analysis didn't come into common discourse until several years later. By that time, remember this is around year 2000, I went to Hebrew school in the 60s. By that time, most American Jews already had a deeply entrenched version of that history that blended perfectly with our still raw feelings of victimhood post-Holocaust. And the media continued to report the terrorist attacks on Israeli cities and how Israel was the democracy in the Middle East. It was almost impossible to learn a clear picture of the reality of Israeli-Palestinian relations before the year 2000. But through the writings of the Israeli revisionist historians, and I think that's an important thing to remember, the Israeli revisionist historians, the Jewish historians who got their hands on this historical record from 1948, it became possible to hear and learn a different narrative. Another side to the story of the miracle. I began to tune into this discussion, especially through a rabbi named Brian Walt. Perhaps some of you know him. He was the founding rabbi of Congregation Mishkan Shalom, where I am a member. He was born and raised in South Africa and had worked to end apartheid in his teenage years. He began to notice similarities between the apartheid government of South Africa and the current Likud government in Israel. He traveled to Israel to see for himself, and gradually he became an anti-Zionist. Urged on by his work, I began to learn more about the politics of Israel, specifically regarding the treatment of Palestinian citizens and non-citizens, those living under occupation. My love for Israel has never dimmed. Rather, I became saddened by the choices the government had made and continues to make. I don't believe these choices are in the best interest of the state. I don't think a state can exist in perpetuity through repression and violence. I believe with all my heart and with all my understanding that peace is the only way to survival. I don't want, and I really want to be clear, I don't want and I don't advocate for an end to Israel. Quite the contrary, I support an Israel that is sustainable, that can grow and develop with its neighbors. And I hope this is not only a dream, but can become a reality. That is why I seek partners of all Abrahamic faiths with whom to work. That is why I have tried to meet Israelis and Palestinians who are doing the work and building the foundation for any future resolution of a shared homeland. But it seems to me that the struggle in which we are engaging is intractable and growing more so with the passing years. And yet, those on the front line are more hopeful than I am. A few years ago, I went on a tour of Bethlehem and its environs with a Palestinian Christian guide. He showed us the newest settlement outpost, explaining that every week or so, a new one popped up. After a few weeks, the outpost became a collection of mobile homes, and after a few months, houses and other buildings would be built, and the settlement would become permanent, no longer just an outpost. He taught us to identify an outpost by the tall antenna they erected first. He took us to the Church of the Nativity and showed us the holes from the mortars from the various attacks on the church. He showed us the school, which had to change the door through which the children entered because the Israeli soldiers fired on the children entering the original school door. He showed us the security wall, quote unquote, built right down the center of the main street of Bethlehem, and all the boarded up shops that went out of business because their customers could no longer get to them. He told us about this family in this this boarded-up shop, who left and went to Lebanon, and the one next door who went to Jordan or Canada, just about anywhere else. On the way back to the checkpoint at the end of the day, I asked him if he thought there would ever be peace, and if the wall would ever come down. He didn't even pause when he answered. He said, "Of course there will be peace." He was a new dad with a 2-week-old son. So I asked him, "In your lifetime or in your son's lifetime?" He answered quickly again, "In my lifetime." I asked him how he could be so confident, and he replied, "Walls always fall in this part of the world." Several years later, on a return visit, this past January, I met the Lutheran pastor, Mitri Rahab, who is a Palestinian Christian fighter for peace, who explained that Palestinian Christians have always lived under some foreign ruler, more or less oppressive, depending on their own inclination. They have seen the rise and fall of all of them, and still life goes on the land. They're not leaving. On this last visit, as I said, almost a year ago, was with an interreligious pilgrimage. We met with faith leaders, politicians, former combatants, people from this group you just saw the film, ordinary citizens, all committed to building peace between the peoples of this land. Several of the Palestinian peace builders who are committed to nonviolent struggle, and this is a tremendous irony, those who are committed to nonviolent struggle, several of them received their training in Israeli prisons. There's some high percentage of Palestinian, especially Palestinian men, who spend a good chunk of their lives in Israeli prisons. And they are educated and they create infrastructures within these prisons, and they teach nonviolence. In prison, they learned about Dr. Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela. They also learned for the first time about the Holocaust. So they learned to understand the backstory of their oppressor, and they learned nonviolent techniques for resisting the oppression. The irony is jolting, but this was not an uncommon occurrence. Unfortunately, it is not the case for most jailed Palestinians. It takes a certain predilection towards peace. So where does this lead me? I want to leave you with a couple of to-dos. As someone committed to my faith, who continuously reads these missives in my faith tradition, I feel the first obligation is to know. Get educated. Listen to firsthand accounts. Learn their stories. Seek out alternative news. 2, once you've heard, if you can go find out for yourself, become a witness. Go see. There's nothing like experiencing it and seeing, going through a checkpoint or some other experience to really bring that knowledge into both body and mind. And then 3, as a witness, because once you've seen, once you know, you must speak the truth. And that is where I have come. I know, and I have seen, and I cannot be silent. As Heschel taught, some are guilty, but all of us are responsible. But here's the thing. If I am going to have the courage to do what I know I should, I need to rely on others to have my back. If I am to succeed in helping Jews overcome their fears of anti-Semitism and annihilation, of still holding that victim mentality, I need to have non-Jewish partners reassuring the Jewish community that anti-Semitism will not be tolerated. Acknowledge that it exists, that it's pernicious, and it will not stand. So our job just got a lot harder since the election a couple weeks ago. I want to leave you with a poem by Yehuda Amichai, one of my favorite Israeli poets. It's called A Temporary Poem of My Time. I would like to give it the title Stones. Hebrew writing and Arabic writing go from east to west. Latin writing from west to east. Languages are like cats. You must not stroke their hair the wrong way. The clouds come from the sea, the hot wind from the desert. The trees bend in the wind, and stones fly from all four winds, into all four winds. They throw stones, throw this land, one at the other, but the land always falls back to the land. They throw the land, want to get rid of it, its stones, its soil, but you can't get rid of it. They throw stones at me in 1936, 1938, 1948, 1988, Semites throw at Semites and anti-Semites at anti-Semites. Evil men throw and just men throw. Sinners throw and tempters throw. Geologists throw and theologists throw. Archaeologists throw and arch-hooligans throw. Kidneys throw stones and gallbladders throw. Headstones and forehead stones and the heart of a stone. Stones shaped like a screaming mouth and stones fitting your eyes like a pair of glasses. The past throws stones at the future, and all of them fall on the present. Weeping stones and laughing gravel stones. Even God in the Bible threw stones. Even the Urim and Tumim were thrown and got stuck in the breastplate of justice. And Herod threw stones, and what came out was a temple. Oh, the poem of stone sadness. Oh, the poem thrown on the stones. Oh, the poem of thrown stones. Is there in this land a stone that was never thrown? And never built and never overturned? And never uncovered and never discovered? And never screamed from a wall and never discarded by the builders? And never closed on top of a grave and never lay under lovers? And never turned into a cornerstone? Please do not throw any more stones. You are moving the land, the holy, whole, open land. You are moving it to the sea, and the sea doesn't want it. The sea says, not in me. Please throw little stones. Throw snail fossils, throw gravel, justice or injustice from the quarries of Migdal Tzedek. Throw soft stones, throw sweet clods, throw limestone, throw clay. Throw sand of the seashore, throw dust of the desert, throw rust, throw soil, throw wind, throw air, throw nothing until your hands are weary.